can't see me, right? Okay,
you guys at the back, you come closer. Why don't you come closer if you just bring your chairs?
Okay, so anyway, I'm honored to be here. I feel at home every time I come here to York University. I was here for almost 10 years as a student, as an undergraduate student and in law school. I worked here as a student. When I started out as a student ambassador, I worked in the admissions office. I also worked as a teaching assistant and a legal or researcher for professors, and lectured as a course director. So, you know, it's always a delight to come back to York, where for me, you know, it all started. And it's a pretty important part of my life, and for who I am right now as a judge. Now, as Professor Green has indicated, you know, I'm a trained lawyer, trained here at Osgoode Hall Law School, graduated in 1989. Before that, I studied economics here as an undergraduate student, and I worked as a teaching assistant, as a lecturer in economics. Done almost all of the various courses in economics, teaching micro, macro, intermediate, macro and microeconomics, as well as developmental economics and econometrics. And then I shifted my focus into the law, and I practiced in criminal law for about 12 years before I was appointed to the Superior Court as a judge. And as a judge, I specialized in adjudicating a lot of high-profile criminal and charter cases. And since June, I've been on the Court of Appeal. So the transition is now complete, thanks. but it's interesting because, is this a law class or what?
It's called Canadian Constitutional Law.
Okay, so you guys are very familiar with case law. and what I'd like to talk to you about today is the case of Regina versus NS, right? Have any of you read this case? No, but you've all heard about it, I'm sure, right? So just to give you a little bit of background information about the case, the case, it's a case, it's actually called R versus MS, right? So to an uncle and a cousin of the complainant, complainant's name was NS, or is NS, were charged with sexually assaulting her, right? And when the matter went to trial, it went to a preliminary hearing. And you know what a preliminary hearing is, right? So this is a trial. It's a preliminary proceeding, an inquiry prior to the actual trial, and this is usually held at the Ontario court level because it's an indictable matter, and so the Crown elects, obviously it was a very serious charge, so the Crown elected to proceed by indictment. And when a criminal matter is proceeded in the courts by indictment, then the accused individuals, they have a choice to elect to be tried either by a court composed of a judge without a jury and without a preliminary inquiry, or a judge and a jury, right? So in this particular case, the matter would have been proceeded with by a judge with a jury. So there would be a preliminary inquiry. So at the preliminary inquiry stage, the complainant, she appeared to give her evidence, and she was fully clothed in a hijab, right? So that means her face was fully covered except for her eyes. And the defense, they challenged that, and they challenged it on the basis of trial fairness, right? You guys have been studying the charter, so that's a part of Section 7 as well, wherein, you know, the accused have a right to a fair trial, and so that his liberty should not be at stake without, you know, proper due process, and without having the rights to challenge, you know, the to challenge the evidence that is before the courts and that he faces. So we all have a right to face our accusers, right? That's the basis, the common law basis of that principle. So the complainant then invoked her religious rights, and pursuant to Section 2 of the Charter, we all have a right to religious freedoms within this country, right, under the Charter. And so what happened is these two very important constitutional rights came into a situation of conflict, right? And the defense argues, well, in situations like that, then, where the liberty of the accused is at stake, then the rights to a fair trial should trump any other rights, especially the rights of the complainant and the rights of the complainant's religious rights, right? Now, one of the important factors in any kind of trial is for a trier of fact. Trier of fact being the trial judge, or in this particular case, it would have been a jury, right? Is for the jury to be able to assess the credibility of the witnesses who are testifying in the court. And how do we do that? Does anyone want to answer that question? How does one go about assessing the credibility of a witness? Yes?
Sometimes they'll look at body language.
Yes?
When they're giving evidence.
Yeah. So facial expressions, body language, and, you know, what the witness says, right? The tone of the witness's voice, the way their eyes, the contact of their eye contact, whole, you know, body expression. And the face is very expressive, right? The face is pretty important within that whole overall context. So the defense argued, well, look, you know, having the face covered, there's absolutely no way that they can then truly assess the credibility of this particular person in light of the seriousness of the allegations, right? And what the complainant says, well, geez, you know, he doesn't need to look at the face of the complainant. They know who the complainant is. In fact, it's a relative, right? So, I mean, it's not that important. Furthermore, in the law, and the case law, if you study a lot of law, there's always conflicting statements from various courts on the importance of demeanor evidence. So when we talk about credibility and facial expressions, what we're talking about is demeanor evidence. And because culturally, right, one person's demeanor may mean something within that particular culture, but within the North American cultural context, it may mean something totally different, right? For example, some cultures, it might be offensive for a young person to look into the eyes of someone with authority, right? Whereas in this particular culture, well, if you don't look into the person's eye that you're speaking to, then it sends a message that you're shady or you're perhaps lying, right? So there's arguments on both sides. So anyway, the preliminary hearing judge was faced with this particular dilemma. And, what do I do? This is the question. Do I rule that the nijab has to come off? And if the nijab comes off, the witness says, well, my religious beliefs are so strong that it would preclude me from proceeding in these proceedings, right? It would preclude her from participating in that court proceeding because religiously she can't remove them. And so it would put a halt or an end to the trial. The trial would not be tried on its merits. Anyways, the preliminary hearing judge, faced with this dilemma, decided that in this particular context, well, rights to a fair trial, it trumps the complainant's religious beliefs and rights pursuant to Section 2 of the Charter. So the matter was halted. The complainant brought her own lawyer, and through her lawyer and the Crown, they appealed. And it was a very significant issue, right? Because we live within the context of a multicultural, pluralistic society where religious freedom is very, very important. And it's not just about religious or pluralistic, tolerance. It's about pluralistic accommodation, right? And so the matter was then appealed to the Court of Appeal. And the Court of Appeal unanimously decided, well, it's not a very easy question, right? They clearly delineate what the issue was. The fact that there's a balancing that has to take place within this type of a situation. And they said, well, in this particular kind of case, what the trial judge has to do is has to look at the sincerity of the belief of the complainant, and if her religious beliefs are sincere, then you have to pay some important deference to that belief, but at the same time you have to balance her interest, her rights, against the rights of the accused to a fair trial and full answer and defense. And if the rights to a fair trial, full answer and defense, is a jeopardy to the rights of the complainant, then the rights of the accused have to prevail. The matter then was, so what they did was they essentially dismissed the appeal. The matter went up to the Supreme Court of Canada, and back in October, in a 6-1 ruling, the Supreme Court, Madam Justice McLaughlin, ruled, yeah, it's a balancing test, but you have to look at the context of the application of the test. And essentially, if the rights of the accused is at jeopardy, then the nijab has to be moved, right? So, but it's interesting in what she said in all of this, right? And she, and I'm just going to quote a couple of her statements. She says, how should the state respond to a witness who sincerely held religious belief requires her to wear a hijab that covers her face except for her eyes while testifying in a criminal proceeding? One response is to say she must always remove her hijab on the ground that the courtroom is a neutral space where religion has no place. And that's some beliefs, right? Some of our legal academics feel that there is no place for religion in the courtroom. And a lot of, you know, states in the United States would also hold that view. On the other hand, she says, another response is to say the justice system should respect the witness's freedom of religion and always permit her to testify with her hijab on. So essentially what she did was she rejected both of those two extreme views. And she says, in my view, both of these extreme views must be rejected in favor of a third option. And the third option is allowing the witness to testify with her face covered, unless this unjustifiably impinges on the accuser's rights to a fair trial. Right? So, she then went on to talk about the underlying principles within the common law system. And she says that a secular response requires witnesses to park their religion at the courtroom door is inconsistent with the jurisprudence in Canadian tradition and limits freedom of religion where no limit can be justified. On the other hand, a response that says a witness can always testify with her face covered may render a trial unfair and lead to wrongful conviction. What is required is an approach that balances the vital rights protecting freedom of religion and trial fairness when they conflict. The long-standing practice in Canadian courts is to respect and accommodate the religious convictions of witnesses unless they pose a significant or serious risk to a fair trial. And she says that the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which protects both freedom of religion and fairness and trial fairness, demands no less. She then concludes, I conclude that a witness who for sincere religious reasons wishes to wear the hijab while testifying in a criminal proceeding will be required to remove it if requiring the witness to remove the hijab is necessary to prevent a serious risk to the fairness of the trial because reasonably available alternative measures will not prevent the risk. And B, the salutary effects of requiring her to remove the hijab, including the effects on trial fairness, outweigh the deleterious effects of doing so, including the effects on freedom of religion. Okay, what does she mean by that, right? Okay, so all she's saying is this. And by the way, what she did was, so they dismissed the appeal, and then they sent it back to the preliminary hearing judge to apply the test that the Supreme Court of Canada outlined as to how to approach this problem. And essentially, the test is this, right? It's a very easy test to apply. The test is, if credibility is an important factor in the determination of the outcome of the trial, where demeanor evidence is going to be essential, right? And the body language and the facial expression of the witness is critical to the determination of the truth of the outcome of the trial, right? So if the trier of fact needs to have a look at the witness who is testifying, and the evidence that's being adduced through this particular witness is evidence that is contentious or contested, then that would balance in favor of the accused's rights to a fair trial in having the nijab removed, right? If the evidence that's being adduced through the witness is non-contentious, for example, the witness does not have an interest in the outcome of the proceeding, and the credibility of the witness's evidence is not an issue, then there's no point in having the witness remove her nijab, right? Because her evidence will not in any way impact trial fairness, right? Because her evidence is not contentious. Do you understand the difference? For example, if you are a witness who is, let's say, an expert witness, right? You're a scientific witness given scientific evidence, and your evidence, you yourself is not a party to the proceeding, and cross-examination of the witness has nothing to do with the witness's own, let's say, knowledge of the truth that has to be unveiled in the case. The evidence is neutral that this witness has to give. Then the balance, right? It then tilts in favor of the witness's rights to religious expression. And so, according to the Supreme Court of Canada, then the nijab is not a factor in the unveiling of the evidence. And so there's no point in removing the nijab. Do you guys see the difference? So it's a pretty simple test, I think. I know that when this came out, when the case came out, and the various commentators were commenting on it, they thought that the Supreme Court copped out. But what I can say is, as a former trial judge, I used to see issues like these all the time, right? And the trial judges are trained to make these decisions. And there's no the law is never black and white, right? And no constitutional or legal issue is ever black and white. There's always areas of gray, right? But this is one of the tests, I think, that is very straightforward, very simple. It recognizes two very important constitutional principles, and it strikes up a very fair balance in terms of its application. And so a trial judge who is faced with a similar type situation, once they have the evidentiary basis, right? And the evidentiary basis has to, it's a pretrial context, right? So what the trial judge has to do is to hold what's called a voir dire. And the voir dire is a trial within a trial, right? And what the voir dire is, the purpose of the voir dire will be to determine what will be the tribal issues in this case, right? And will the evidence of the person who is wearing the nijab be critical to the determination of the of that witness's credibility and the outcome of the trial. And if it's not, then the trial judge will have to say, well, it isn't. So her religious beliefs trumps, right? Trumps the fair trial basis, because it's not a factor. Yes. Okay, I can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. Our pastor today, we were talking a lot about preferred uses and trials being sort of wrong for different reasons.
Right.
Would that also be taken into consideration? So if you accuse a person's motivation for making a claim like that, is he really concerned about having a fair trial, or is it
No. I'll tell you why, right? Because, okay, so in this particular case, because it was a very novel issue, right? I thought, yeah, there was a delay, and it took a couple of months. I think it took a year, actually, the issue came before the preliminary hearing judge in October of 2010, and it took about 2 years before it was determined at the Supreme Court of Canada. But let's say this issue comes up again, right? The test is already made out. It would take no longer than a half a day, in my view, for a trial judge to determine this issue.
Would that be something the trial judge would take into consideration? Would be the person's, is it valid?
Delay is always a valid issue, right?
Yeah.
But delay cannot trump an accuser's rights to a fair trial, right? I mean, the way that the system is situated is that every one of us, right, regardless of who you and I are, you could be charged with something tomorrow, right? Like, you got to think like that. Yeah, but you know what? So if he's guilty, he's presumed to be innocent until he is found to be guilty. And that's just the way the system works. And it's there to protect you as well as the accused. Right? So there's a presumption of innocence on all of us, regardless of what we're charged with. Regardless of who charges us, right? Because the fact of the matter is, we're not in a police state, right? And so there are due processes in the law that are there to protect the rights of each and every one of us. Now, if he's guilty, eventually he will be found guilty, right? And these procedural issues are there to protect him, but once we go through the process, at the end of the day, he will still be found guilty. I mean, these police, okay, I'll give you an example, right? Like, I mean, there are these charges of police officers who were charged with obstructing justice and stealing from some accused. Now, a lot of them, they got off the more serious charges. It took about 12 years, right? And one may argue that the accused individuals that were charged, they challenge every minute detail and aspect of the charges that they were facing. And as a result of that, the matter was protracted through the system for 12 years, right? But then they were found guilty of obstruction of justice, and they were eventually sentenced, and they then brought this argument that Jesus' matter took so long that we've suffered so much, right? So that we should be given some kind of a reprieve for our suffering, right? But anyway, at the end of the day, though, right? Justice still should prevail. Yes.
The first question, I have two questions, if that's fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
First question I have is, I can feel my temperature go up a little bit, so I was just thinking about, in that sort of judgment, I get that
In the Nijab case.
Yes. But I guess that I can get that the test that's come out from the Supreme Court is one that's fairly easy to use. I think for me, though, in my experience of working with the area of sex assault, credibility is often the cornerstone, especially in cases where it's a he said, she said sort of situation. Mm-hmm. So out of all of this, I guess my concern or my fear is, what is that like for a Muslim woman who wears a niqab and has been sexually assaulted and ends up going to a trial? Because of the whole issue of credibility being such a big part of sex assault, I'm concerned for those women. Like, I hear the whole piece around the little law, but I don't know, it's just not, I don't know why it's not sitting so well with me.
Okay, but the alternative is, right? I mean, the alternative is that you remove the credibility aspect of this case, and you're gonna find the accused guilty without testing the evidence, right? And I hear you, and I agree with you that it's difficult but these cases are all very difficult, and I can tell you that. Okay, so with respect to sexual assault, right? What I can tell you is this, is that the courts have been very sensitive to okay, I'm going to be very careful. The courts, over the years, right? Over the last, let's say, maybe 25 to 30 years, the courts have been very sensitive to the needs of women. Okay? So it used to be a lot more difficult to prove sexual assault cases. There used to be the requirement of corroboration. Right? It used to be that you could challenge a woman's sexual history. Right? The courts have removed all of that. Like, so just because a woman consented to a prior sexual act with an individual does not mean that on a particular occasion that is alleged that she has been assaulted, that she has consented, right? The case was called Seaboy, or this came out in the 1990s, right? So the law has been moving in tune with the 21st century, or the 20th century, right? There used to be, you know, 25 years ago, if a woman could not provide some kind of corroboration that she was sexually assaulted by some person, right, then a he said, she said case would never even proceed to trial. That's no longer the case. And I can assure you that on numerous cases, more cases than not, he said, she said, the woman is believed, the guy is convicted. That's my experience. Both as a prosecutor, I used to be a crown attorney, and defense lawyer as a judge, trial judge, and now as the court of appeal. Yes. I never said that. I never said that. I never said that. What I said, right? What I said, I was reading. No. The good thing is I'm a lawyer. Right? What I said, right, was that, and I read from the case. Justice McLaughlin said, how should the state respond to a witness who sincerely held religious belief requires her to wear a niqab, okay. that covers her face except for her eyes while testifying in a criminal proceeding. One response is to say she must always remove her hijab on the ground that the courtroom is a neutral space where religion has no place. Another response is to say the justice system should respect the witness's freedom of religion and always permit her to testify with the niqab on. In my view, both of these extremes must be rejected in favor of a third option, allowing the witness to testify with her face covered, unless this unjustifiably impinges on the accuser's fair trial rights. Right? So I never said that. Yeah, and that, the whole basis of the case. But what I've said is this: the whole basis of the case is on the premise that religion is a part of our system, and that the courts recognize the rights of individual religious freedoms. Right? But at the same time, there is an equal and countervailing right within a criminal trial proceeding where there's a right to a fair trial on the part of the accused. So that's the conflicting rights that the court was faced with. Okay. Yes. Okay. I'll ask this lady.
There's so many things wrong with this case.
It's only the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I can't believe that they don't do it so, like, I don't know, this way, because I think they didn't deal with it the way they should have.
Okay, so tell us why they should have dealt with it differently.
I think first the test is not guaranteed partiality.
Why did you stand up over there and face everybody? They all hear you.
Why is that, though? Tell me why.
Because I think judges are humans anyways, even though they are trained, their own personal beliefs.
No. But the judge cannot import their personal beliefs in this. What the judge is doing is applying the evidence based on the charge that is before the court, and whether or not that witness has an interest in the outcome of the case. Whether or not the witness's interest is neutral or not. So that has nothing to do with the judge's views.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
And the other one is equality between women. So it means
okay, how is that?
Because it means that those women who wear niqab and they're Muslims, they have this extra bonus.
They have what? Who the
Western women, like Canadians or
yeah, but
not Muslim.
But
they have an extra hurdle to jump through in order to be incredibly important.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of times, like in small communities, like in Muslim communities, Western women are considered as not as moral as Muslim women.
They're not as considered, but that's based on the Muslim community.
Yes.
Okay. How does it prove
it? Because based on their belief, they can be different. And I think, and their religion doesn't.
No, I okay, so, can I just say this? If the court had said, under no circumstances should these women be able to wear their niqab in the courtroom, I would agree with what you said. Right? Your argument would have some validity. But the court didn't say that. The court said that under most circumstances where credibility of that particular witness is not an issue, then they will be able to wear the niqab.
Yes, but why?
I'm sorry?
I think the option should not be on the table. I think all witnesses should be treated equally, and I think it's not.
Okay, so what are you saying then? I'm confused.
And I know, because Islam does not require me to cover the faces.
Okay, so what, wait. Okay, so are you saying that the court made a mistake in giving the judges an option, and what the court should have done is say no niqab in the courtroom?
Yes.
No niqab in the courtroom. Okay, but that would be a problem with our religious, with the adherence of the religious aspects of our constitutional rights. Right? Because who am I to judge the sincerity of your religion? And if your religious beliefs are protected under Section 2 of the Charter, then I have to adhere to the sincerity of your beliefs. Okay, so I think that these issues are not that easy. Right?
Yes.
And they're competing and countervailing issues here. And what the judge did, what the court did, was they striked up a balance and they said, well, look, if your credibility is not determinative of the outcome of this case, if your evidence is neutral, then you should be able to wear your niqab. And it shouldn't be an issue, right? If credibility is a factor and the rights to a fair trial is going to be impeded or is going to be somehow challenged, then that should trump your opinion. So I think it's a critical balance. Okay, yes. Okay, that I'll ask this gentleman, yeah?
Maybe for clarity, could you provide another example of another sliding scale in providing evidence to maybe get away from the contentiousness? Obviously, this would be a contentious issue whether you're talking about who's providing testimony or I'm trying to think of another example, and maybe you could provide one that could maybe sort of demonstrate what the court was trying to do, but without sort of the heavy
Okay, I'm not exactly sure what you're asking, because the issue was contentious, right? And that's why it was before the court.
But providing, I guess, that in one case where an individual could protect their identity.
Oh, I see. Okay, I got you. Okay, yeah. So why don't I give you this example, right? And the court. So listen to this, right? Like the court actually gave an example. Right? What the court said was this. However, whether the ability to observe a witness's face impacts trial fairness is in any particular case, it depends on the evidence that the witness is to provide. Right? So I'm reading directly from the case. The court says where evidence is uncontested, credibility assessment and cross-examination are not an issue. So cross-examination is really critical here because that's what usually brings out the credibility of the witness. Therefore, being unable to see the witness's face will not impinge on the accused's fair trial rights. As noted in a particular case, the risk to trial fairness must be real and substantial. Right? It's a real and substantial test that the court imported. Or, in other words, the risk must be a serious one. If wearing the niqab poses no serious risk to trial fairness, a witness who wishes to wear it for sincere religious reasons may do so. So she then goes on to give some examples, and she says, this brings me to the final reason for rejecting an approach that would never allow a witness to testify while wearing a religious facial covering. It does not comport with the fundamental premise underlying the Charter that charter that rights should be limited only to the extent that the limits are shown to be justifiable. This principle is set out in Section 1 of the Charter in relation to laws. Laws that limit the rights guaranteed by the Charter are invalid to the extent that the limit is not reasonably justified in a free and democratic society. She says that a total ban on religious facial coverings for all evidence given by all witnesses in the courtroom would mean that freedom of religion is being limited in situations where there is no good reason for the limit. As discussed above, uncontested, uncontroversial evidence does not engage the fair trial interest. A total ban that would permit the state to intrude on freedom of religion where it cannot be justified is not consistent with the premise on the charter, on which the charter is based. And she says a generous approach to defining the scope of the rights it confers, coupled with the need to justify intrusion on those rights because of conflicting interest or the public good. Right? So I gave you the example of let's say, a witness who is testifying as an expert witness. Take, for example, a witness who works in a group home, right? And the witness comes to court as a support person, is asked to testify as to things that happened with a child in that group home, right? That's evidence that's more or less the witness probably would not have an interest in, and the witness would then, you know, because of their religious beliefs or sincerely held religious beliefs, they may require or request the court to wear this niqab. So the court would then determine whether or not the witness's evidence is of such that her credibility is going to be critical to the outcome of the case. And the witness and the court would then say, well, it isn't. So there isn't an issue with trial fairness. And so on in the balance, her religious rights should be protected.
We have to get back to class momentarily, so there'll be time for one more question. Do you want me to choose a question?
Yeah,
or do
you
want
choose.
I choose. Okay. Yes, you've been trying for some time, so go ahead.
Yes.
Last question.
Okay, I can't hear you.
That sounds like a very creative solution. Michael, could a trial judge decide that that might be an acceptable solution in some cases?
Okay. Just to sort of give you some background, right? In situations of trial witnesses, right? They're able to testify from closed circuit televisions, or they're able to testify through screens, right? And the criminal code actually provides for that. So there's been amendment to the code to provide for, the evidence of what we call vulnerable witnesses in sexual assault cases or cases involving child abuse and so forth. In a situation like that, you know what? That was one of the positions that was put before both the Court of Appeal I can tell you that there were a number of interveners who had testified at the Court of Appeal, and certainly that was a position that was also advanced at the Supreme Court of Canada. But, you know, that's always a last resort, right? Because what you're doing is not, it's not the right of the witness that we're dealing with here only. You got to remember that the rights of the accused is also the one that is paramount before the court. And the common law rights of the accused, one of the principles, the fundamental principles of the common law is for the accused to face the accuser. And one of the principles, one of the way that that is usually, you know, a trial is a contentious exercise or a proceeding. And it's contentious for a good reason. Because we're not in an inquisitorial system where that might work, where you go before the judge of your choice, a female judge. We're in a contentious. I'm sorry? Yeah, but I think they have respected the woman's right to privacy here, right? In this case. I mean, the whole issue, and whether or not I would have decided this case the same way, it's probably, you know, immaterial. But what I'm saying is, you know, it's a balance. It's not a perfect solution, but it's a good solution. And it takes into account the difficulties of demeanor evidence and the need to see the witness's face in a contentious situation. And I'll tell you, the court quoted a New Zealand court decision, and it's significant, and I'll read it to you, because they took some time, Justice McLaughlin, to note this particular case. By the way, Justice McLaughlin is a female judge, right? She's the Chief Justice of Canada. She's one of the leading proponents, in my view, of the advancement of women rights. Since she became Chief Justice of that court, we now almost have an equal balance of female and male judges on the court. And there's almost a 50% balance of male and female judges on the Superior Court, certainly in Ontario. And on the Court of Appeal, there's a significant, there aren't a lot of us on that court, but there's a good percentage that are female judges, right? So you got to understand, right, that also on this particular court, you know, the majority of the female judges, they agreed with this decision. Anyway, the quote is this, right? And what this does is it encapsulates the difficulties of demeanor evidence. And this is a case, it's a New Zealand judge asked to decide whether witnesses could testify wearing burqas. Commented. And a burqa is not the same as a niqab, right? Am I asked? Can I ask you guys that? And the burqa. Oh, I see. Okay, so the burqa is.
There are different types of burqas. It depends if it's an Afghan. The only thing that you see is just the.
I see. So the hijab, it covers the mouth, right?
Hijab should cover the eye. It should let the eyes open.
Okay. So it's a similar kind of situation that this particular judge was faced with. So what the judge said was this. There are types of situations in which the demeanor of a witness undergoes a quite dramatic change in the course of his or her evidence. The look which says, I hoped not to be asked that question. Sometimes even a look of downright hatred, a counsel by a witness who obviously senses he or she is getting trapped, can be expressive. So too can abrupt changes in mode of speaking, facial expressions, or body language. A witness who moves from expressing himself calmly to an excited gabble. The witness who, from speaking clearly, with good eye contact, becomes hesitant and starts looking at his feet. The witness who, at a particular point, becomes flustered and sweaty. All provide examples of circumstances which, despite cultural and language barriers, convey, at least in part, by his or her facial expression, a message touching credibility. Right, so it's not an easy, this was not an easy issue that they had to decide. I think the easiest way to decide this case would have been to do one or the other, right? But like I said, what the court was trying to do was to come up with a balance. And if you're studying constitutional law, you're gonna find that throughout the areas, not just in this particular case, but throughout the areas of the law. There's no easy solution, right? And that's why not everybody is a lawyer, or not everybody is a constitutional specialist, because it's not that easy, right? And I think you guys are graduate students in this course, am I right? And that's what you have to grapple with as you go up. And that's another thing, right? I hate to take up more of your time, right?
They're learning a lot.
But you guys are, this is a public policy administration course, and you guys are going to be asked to make important decisions. And what you have to do is understand the fundamental principles underlying a lot of these decisions that you're going to be asked to make. Now, I may be hiring one of you, or some of you, in some years to come. And if you come and give me a very simplistic answer and say, well, you know, why don't I do this for this reason? Like, how is that going to help me grapple with a very difficult question? Right, it isn't. So what you have to do is you have to think, and that's what this course is teaching you to do, and that's why it's so important to grapple with these issues. Yes? Sorry.
I'm sorry, Professor. First of all, thank you for coming here and letting us ask questions, because that rarely happens, us asking questions. the previous point, I think the reason in that case of the law becomes difficult, because I guess in our court administration, and also in the realm of judges and the lawyers, there's not a lot of familiarity with the laws of this law and laws that have a significant importance to the job of one. If that's studied,
I'm not in a position to give you my opinion on any decision that I have made or any other judges have made, because I am in the business of making decisions that are just.
Justice Tulloch, thank you so much for coming today. This is something that the students here will remember forever. And I really appreciate you taking it.
Okay.
Can you stick around to go to the absinthe in an hour, or do you need to go?
Well, you know what? Unfortunately, I can't stick around, but I would love to come back. It was a pleasure.
Wonderful. We'll ask you back. Just as you're going out, I'll introduce you to the two undergrad students.
Okay, great.
They're the ones who want to come down and see you.
Okay, excellent.